Michael Slade Show. I'm your host, Michael Slade, and we have a packed show for you today. Way down at the back end of the show, we are going to be rerunning an interview I did a number of years ago with Jim Loewen. And we'll be talking with Jim, a historian, about the a book he wrote on the Confederacy. And we'll give you all the information when we get to that section of the show. Before that, I'm going to run a very special segment of the show. And this is some statements that I pre-recorded about a week ago that actually were with people whose family members have been killed by the police. And these people are involved in the call for a massive 3 days of activities and a massive demonstration in New York City this fall. And the initiative is called Which Side Are You On? Rise Up October. And opening the show up, I'm very pleased to be bringing you a segment I did recently with the director of the film, The Look of Silence. This is an incredibly powerful film. Now, Joshua's first film was also on Indonesia, and it told the story from the perpetrators of the mass slaughter, the slaughter of up to a million people in the 1960s. And that film was called The Act of Killing. Now, this film is called The Look of Silence, and it's considered the twin to the first film. During the 1950s and early 1960s, Indonesia had the third largest communist party in the world. The Indonesian party had a massive following among the poor in the urban slums, as well as among the peasants in the countryside and sections of the intellectuals, and among certain forces who were more nationalist bourgeois strata. The government at the time was headed up by the nationalist leader Ahmed Sukarno. In 1965, the U.S., through the CIA, working with the Indonesian military and a leading general, Suharto, carried out a bloody coup in which hundreds of thousands of communists and others were slaughtered. In the course of this coup, the rivers around Jakarta became clogged with the bodies of the victims. The reactionaries would kill people and throw their bodies into the rivers. And in a phenomenon that's all too familiar, once this coup, which the CIA led, organized and engineered, was unleashed and carried out, all kinds of people who were involved in personal or family disputes and feuds would start accusing other people of being communists and would turn them into the authorities, with the result that a whole lot of people who weren't communists were also slaughtered along with people who were communists. Once the imperialists and reactionaries unleashed this bloodletting, this encouraged and gave impetus to and swept many people up in a kind of bloodlust of revenge. It's just the type of world we live in, folks. So without any further ado, here's my interview with Josh Oppenheimer, the director of the film, The Look of Silence. All right, I'm really happy to welcome to the show my guest, Joshua Oppenheimer. He's the film director of the movie that actually shook the world up like crazy a few years back called The Act of Killing. And it told the story of the perpetrators of one of the largest mass killings in modern history. And he's followed that film up with a new film called The Look of Silence, which is being released in the U.S. now. And he's joining us to talk about it now. So, Joshua, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. Let's start by talking about the two films. From the very beginning, you've said that these two films have been connected, and you said that you knew fairly on in the filming of The Act of Killing that the second film was going to be made. Why? What's the relationship?
Well, the two films are companion pieces to one another. Together with the uncut version of The Act of Killing, the so-called director's cut, as it's called here in the United States and as it's been released here in the United States, the two films form a single work whose whole, I hope, is greater than the sum of the parts. And I knew I would make two films, actually a full year and a half before I met the main character in The Act of Killing, Anwar Kongo, in January 2004, when I first came to the conclusion that the impunity for the perpetrators in Indonesia, it's as though one wandered into Germany 40 years after the Holocaust, if the Nazis were still in power and if the rest of the world had celebrated the Holocaust while it was taking place. I decided then and there I would make one film about the lies, the fantasies, the stories the perpetrators tell so they can live with themselves, and the terrible consequences of those lies on the whole society. And the second, what does it do to human beings to have to live for half a century afraid?
One of the things that comes across very powerfully in relation to all that is you have Adi, the main character in The Look of Silence. And Adi's actually, I mean, the juxtaposition between him and all of the other characters in the film in terms of the people that the perpetrators that he's actually questioning. And he's sort of a stand-in for the vast majority of Indonesian people that suffered under this. And he's questioning these perpetrators, but the whole way you frame that, and I think this has a lot to do with the way you've talked about the cinema actually being something more intuitive and using a lot of imagery, but this point of the back and forth between him and the voice of sort of like reason and morality and whatnot, and then these wanton killers, it's like it really just grabs you from the very beginning.
Well, I think that it's Adi's gaze, Adi's face, when he confronts the man who killed his brother, which I should say is something unprecedented in the history of cinema. This is the first film ever where survivors confront perpetrators while the perpetrators still have basically a monopoly on power, because it's normally too dangerous to do that. And Adi goes and confronts them, and confronted with his willingness to understand, not to excuse, but to understand, to try to empathize, and if they can take responsibility and acknowledge what they've done is wrong, to forgive, they are forced to look in the mirror in a way. In his, through him, through his questions, they're confronted with this kind of moral mirror, and all the lies that they tell and to justify what they've done so they can live with themselves, I think start to appear to themselves as lies. And as these cracks in their facade begin to appear, guilt and shame and fear of their own guilt rush in.
I'll have to go back and look at the film again, because I thought there was some of that, but there was a certain amount of arrogance that happened with a lot of these people that were actually directing this slaughter. And when you look at it, when Adi's talking to them, and they boast that the descriptions of what they've done, a lot of that was taken from your older film. But when Adi's talking to them in this film and the questions that he's asked, it's a very heavy scene there, because things get very, very tense. And you've even said that filming those interviews with Adi talking to these perpetrators was even more dangerous than what you did in your first film, The Act of Killing.
First of all, you're right that they become arrogant. They're not, after I think there's this guilt and fear of their own guilt, then they have to improvise new excuses. You see, Adi's presence, his humanity, makes it clear that all the lies they've told themselves to justify what they've done are lies, and they now are scrabbling for new excuses, ranging from trying to insist that the victims deserved what happened to them to saying, look, I wasn't responsible, and threatening Adi, if you continue to look into this, they fall back on their own power, which is considerable, and they threaten him and say, if you continue to look into this, this could happen again, and to you.
Yeah, that was the scene I was thinking about. There's that one guy that says, well, look here, I'll tell you what, man. One, you're asking questions that are too deep and you're talking political. And then the other cat that says, you know, open communists are not the enemy today. They're not the danger today. It's the secret communists. And he's looking right at Adi, right? And you're thinking, yikes, what's going to happen now?
Yeah, he says, continue with this secret communist activity. Just continue and see what happens. Of course, the fact that we had made the act of killing but not yet released it meant that when Adi first told me he wanted to confront the men who killed his brother, I said right away, absolutely not. It's too dangerous. This has never been done before in film, and we can't do it. No way. And Adi said, I need to do this because I want to make sure that I create a future for my children where they're not afraid of their neighbors. The perpetrators are unwilling or unable to break the silence. Let me go to them and tell them, and try and break that silence and show that I'm not here to punish or for revenge. I'm here to forgive if they can admit what they've done was wrong, so that we can live together as human beings and my children needn't grow up afraid. I thought about this and I realized, first of all, that the production of the act of killing was well known across the region, because some of the most powerful men in the country, the vice president of the country, for example, ministers in the cabinet, members of parliament, the governor of the province, all had participated in the film. Because the film had not yet come out, had not yet screened anywhere, I was believed to be close to the highest ranking perpetrators in the country. And so these men Adi wanted to confront, regionally but not nationally powerful, would not dare to detain us, let alone physically attack us, because they wouldn't want to upset their superiors. But I also realized that we were unlikely to get that apology Adi was hoping for, and I told him that. I said, 5 years filming the perpetrators making the act of killing, the main character in the end is retching over what he's done. And in the director's cut of the film, the uncut version of the film, while he's retching, he's still clinging to lies, justifying it. He says, I killed because my conscience told me they had to be killed. He still can't let go of the excuse. So I don't think in an hour and a half with the perpetrators, you, Adi, will be able to get that apology, but we can try. What I also said was, though, if I can film why we fail, the fear, the guilt, the fear of their own guilt, and then the defensive reactions that follow, the anger, the threats, then I can show how torn this society is and make it impossible for anybody who sees the film not to support truth and reconciliation. And through the film, we might therefore succeed in a much bigger way than where we fail in the individual confrontations.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Joshua Oppenheimer. Joshua is the director of the film The Look of Silence, which is the partner film of his first film, The Act of Killing, both of which tell the story of the 1965-66 genocidal assault on communists and many other people. Up to 1 million people were killed in Indonesia. One of the things that you actually brought out, too, in a very good way, I thought, was you talk about that this is not just something that happened. These were not monsters. That these were actually pretty run-of-the-mill people who actually got caught up in ideological and political forces that were just unleashed all this terrible stuff in the world. And I thought that was pretty important to recognize that people, you know, when you think back about Germany, going back to your Nazi comparison, you think back about Germany when there were areas where, you know, the Gestapo had like tens of thousands or, you know, whatever numbers of people that they had just arrested, they thrown in the concentration camps, they killed. And it was this area where the people were all sort of, you know, civil to one another, and it was these nice little villages. And they found out, you're thinking, when you're looking at that and you're thinking, okay, they must have had like, you know, 1,000 Gestapo agents there. And they actually had about 10. And they relied on the cooperation of the local population and these people who got caught up in all of this. We can look back and say, yes, it was extremely heinous that what they were doing. And it was just a terrible, inhuman and, you know, whatever regime, you know, just a regime that really did need to be stood up and stopped. But it seems like there's a lot of that was going on in relation to all this, too.
Yeah, well, Primo Levi, actually speaking about the Holocaust and the perpetrators, said, very aptly, Primo Levi said, there may be monsters among us, but they are too few to worry about. And the recognition, which came to me pretty early on, that the perpetrators are human, like us, at first it's terrifying to accept, because it means that if we grew up in their families, we grew up in their communities, we grew up at that time, we might make the decisions that they make. And while we would all hope we would make different decisions, we're all very lucky never to have to find out. And once you get over that fear that comes, the fearful thought that we might be like the perpetrators in some way, and in fact, I think we're all closer to perpetrators than we like to think, given the involvement of the United States in such crimes. Once you get over that fear, you also recognize that acknowledging the humanity of the perpetrators is the only hopeful stance. Because, first of all, if we are to have any chance of preventing these things, we have to listen to how human beings do these things and then live with what they've done and the consequences of that. And secondly, if the perpetrators are human, it ought to be possible to build societies where we foster the widest possible human empathy. We teach people to practice the widest possible human empathy, and also teach people to doubt, what authority tells them, so that it's more difficult to incite people to betray their personal morality and join groups that are doing things that they know are wrong. In that sense, if we can build societies of empathy and doubt and criticism and questioning, then we ought to be able to find a way of living where this kind of unthinkable violence one day truly becomes unimaginable.
You know, it's interesting, though, because you talk about this throughout the film in different ways. And sometimes I'm watching and I'm thinking, God, it's the banality of evil. But it's more than that. It's exactly what you're just talking about. It's not just sort of this, you know,
the humanity of evil.
Yeah, exactly. But humanity and the capacity of humans to be evil and to be good. And that's the question that it got to me, because as I was watching it, and especially I think the second time I saw it, it was this thing, it became sort of the center of it, with Adi at the center of it, the juxtaposition of him and all these killers there. And his mother and his family and whatnot. And you see them on one side and then you see the killers on the other. But I'm watching it and it seemed to me to become sort of something that was much more rooted in an issue of morality and courage in the face of tremendous immorality and criminal things like the execution of 1 million people. And that question is posed to us heavily today. You know, what side are you on? What do you do in the face of tremendous evil being unleashed in the world? And that seemed to be a really big thing in that. And I thought that was captured in a discussion between Adi and his uncle just saying, hey, what could I do? And Adi saying, you could have stood up and said something, man.
Well, it's such a terrible scene also. It was one of the worst things I've ever seen, that scene, really. Actually, it's one of the confrontations between Adi and a perpetrator where we had no idea that the uncle was a perpetrator. We were actually filming, it was just meant to be a nice scene where Adi's testing his uncle's eyes and showing what he does for a living and talking a little bit about the family, what Adi's mother was like when she was a child and so forth. And it turns out that the uncle was involved with guarding the prisoners just before they were taken away to be killed, and he knew they were being killed. What begins as a loving moment and a real relief in the middle of this film when Hadi goes and visits him, we feel dread, oh no, he's visiting another perpetrator. But no, it's a very loving moment. And I guess spoiling the scene a little bit, by the end of the scene, the uncle is saying essentially your brother deserved to be killed, and if you continue to stand up to this, you also deserve to be killed. If you continue to speak out like this and accuse me, you also might deserve to be killed. So what begins as a loving relationship by the end is really broken. And it's a terrible, tragic development. We see a relationship of love end as fundamentally unsafe for both of them. It's one of the most terrible things that one's seen. And we see that people again and again lack the courage to stand up and are easily incited to join groups and do things that betray everything they believe in. And that they'll, and then, like the uncle, they're so afraid of their own guilt that they'll tell themselves stories, cling to excuses that justify what they've done, even if it means betraying the other people whom they love.
Let me ask you this, because you mentioned earlier the point about the role of the U.S. and the West in what happened in Indonesia, and particularly the U.S. I mean, I have to tell you a real quick story. I used to be a cab driver in D.C., and one night I got a call to pick somebody up at the CIA headquarters. And this guy gets in, he's dead drunk, and he starts talking to me as we're driving along. He starts talking to me about, you don't know what it's like. I've never seen anything better than to watch rivers of blood. I was in Indonesia, and this is what happened, and this was what I was responsible for. And I was like, I didn't know whether he was telling the truth or not, but the fact that he would talk about it that way. And I kept thinking about this whole thing of the role of the U.S. in this, because you've done a good exposure in there. And I think it's something people don't realize, that the U.S. actually was a foundational thing for how that developed and what happened afterwards.
What an amazing story you've just told. I would love to know who that man was. I did actually have the peculiar privilege of interviewing an American embassy official named Robert Martins, who talked proudly of compiling lists of thousands of names of public figures, journalists mostly, but also trade union leaders, leaders of the Indonesian women's movement, writers, artists, public figures, and handing them over to the Indonesian army and saying, go down this list and kill everyone on it and tick off the names as you go and give the list back when you're done. He talked about it as though this death list was somehow crucial intelligence, but these were public figures, and the army was deployed in every hamlet in the country, so they would know who their opponents are. What it was really doing was giving an unmistakable signal, go after everybody, kill everybody. We want everybody who might be opposed to the new military dictatorship to be killed because we want this anti-communist regime to stick. But if we think it was all just done for ideological anti-communism, there's a moment in The Look of Silence that ought to give us pause and lead us to question that. There's a moment where we hear that Goodyear, the multinational tire and rubber corporation, was on their plantations in Indonesia. It's an NBC News report that documents how they were using slave labor drawn from death camps to harvest their rubber. This is just 20 years after German corporations did the same thing on the periphery of Auschwitz, using slave labor from death camps. But here it's being reported openly on American television as something done in the name of freedom and democracy. And for all viewers of my film that care about freedom and democracy, this should lead us to question whether anti-communism was the real reason for this, or whether it was more an excuse that allowed people to act on behalf of other interests, which allowed anti-communism, or rather, whether the so-called free world struggle against the communist world in defense of freedom and democracy was but an excuse for murderous plunder.
Now, let me ask you one more question, and this has to do with the thing that I mentioned earlier on about your comment that cinema has to be more intuitive than anything else, and the imagery you use from the beginning to the end. I mean, it just, if I just turned the sound down and watched the film, and I tried it for a little bit, just the things that swept over me with the imagery, from the larval, I don't know what they were, the things we used to call jumping beans here, right? And all the things that were concentrated in that as they sat there and jumped, and why do you jump, and what's in, it's because what's inside of you, or to the window shots of the black dust, and then to Adi's father and what happened to him in the end, the way he was lost in terror. I wanted to know if you could talk about that particular image, that Adi's father lost in terror.
The scene you're asking about was really one of the most important scenes in the film for me, because it's the scene that actually motivated us to make this film. When I finished shooting The Act of Killing in early 2010, I gave Adi Rukun a camera, a small camera to use as a kind of notebook to look for images that might inspire the making of the second film. And he would send me tapes while I was editing The Act of Killing. When I returned in early 2012, after editing The Act of Killing, but before it come out to make The Look of Silence, we sat down and I said, want to do for the second film? What do you think we should do? And he said, I need to meet the men who killed my brother. I've spent 7 years watching your footage with the perpetrators. It's changed me. I need to meet them. And I said instantly, absolutely not. Impossible. There's no way. It's too dangerous. There's never been a film where survivors confront perpetrators who are still in power. And Adi said, let me show him why it matters. And he went and got that camera that I'd given him, and he came with one tape and said, I'm sorry I never sent you this tape because it's very personal to me. And trembling, he put the tape in the camera, pressed play, and immediately started to cry and showed me the one scene in the film that Adi shot, and that's the scene of his father crawling lost in his own home, calling for help. And Adi said to me, Joshua, this was the first day my father could not remember in his old age, in his senility. He could not remember me, my brothers and sisters, or my mother. And all day he was confused like this, and we were trying to help him, to comfort him, but we couldn't, because every time we'd go up to him, we were strangers to him, and he would become more afraid and scream unbearably. And we didn't know what to do. It was horrible to not be able to do anything. So eventually, after hours of this, I picked up the camera, he explained, and started to film. And the moment I started to film, he said, I knew why I was filming, because this is the moment where it's too late for my father to heal. He's forgotten the son whose murder destroyed his life, his whole family's life, but he hasn't forgotten the fear. So he's like a man, he'll never heal because he can't remember what happened. He'll never work through that fear. So he's like a man locked in a room who can't even find the door, let alone the key. We watched the scene play out to the end, and then he said to me, you see, I don't want my children to inherit this prison of fear from my father, my mother, and from me. And I hope if I go and visit the perpetrators, I can make peace with my neighbors. Well, I realized we wouldn't be able to make peace with these neighbors through these visits, but we might be able to show how broken this society is, how urgently truth, reconciliation, and justice are needed, and therefore succeed in a bigger way. But I also realized that this shouldn't just be a political film about impunity and coexistence between powerful perpetrators and terrified survivors. This must also be a film about memory and oblivion, and to answer your question about images in general, a kind of visual poem, highly dramatic because of the confrontations, but a poem nonetheless, backward-looking, composed in memoriam to all that's destroyed, not just the dead who can never be wakened, of course, but also somehow the lives broken by half a century of fear that can never be made whole again, because whatever truth and reconciliation might come in the future, perhaps in part as a result of my two films, it is too late for Adi's father to heal, and I had this sense that the film should end with that scene.
All right, Joshua Oppenheimer, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Okay, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Joshua Oppenheimer, the director of the film The Look of Silence. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to some of the family members of people who have been killed by the police. So stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Police Brutality by Ziggy Marley and the Melody Makers. This coming fall, there's been a call for a massive series of activities all around the country and culminating in a massive action in New York City on October 24th. At this point, a lot of people know about this, but there's still many, many more people who need to know but don't know. And so I'm going to be running a regular segment that talks about October 24th and the days leading up to it, the 22nd and the 23rd of October, which will also feature big actions around the country and in New York City. But October 24th is the concentration, the focal point of it all. And so to talk about October 24th, I'm bringing you the voices of two people whose loved ones were killed by the police in different parts of Southern California. First up is Erica Parker. Erica Parker is the sister of Dante Parker, who was murdered by San Bernardino sheriffs. On August 12th, the San Bernardino sheriffs murdered Dante Parker, an unarmed black man. Dante was riding his bicycle near his home when a homeowner reported that a black man was trying to enter her home. Dante was shot between 10 and 25 times by a taser while he was hogtied laying down on the ground. Dante's sister, Erica, is joining us now to read a statement that she made recently in connection to October 24th, Rise Up October, the day of a massive outpouring of resistance to the police murder of black and brown people, to the slow genocide that's being carried out against black and brown people by the police in this society, and the fight to stop it. So without any further ado, I want to introduce Erica. Erica, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. It's extremely important, and I'm really glad to have you, and I want as many people as possible to hear what you have to say. You have become a supporter of October 24th, right?
Yes.
And why was that?
Because our family has been going through a struggle since my brother has passed away, and it's been extremely hard, you know, to really get people to realize what's going on. So I think October 24th is an outstanding idea.
You wrote a statement that's been published in Revolution newspaper. It's been published on the RevCom site. It's been published at the Stop Mass Incarceration site. And I want people all over the country to hear it. So why don't we have you read your statement about October 24th?
October 24th is an outstanding idea. I think the vision can become reality with the help of those who understand just how much this is needed. And for those who don't, this may be what they need to understand that people are being murdered daily and no one is being held accountable. Help them to realize that someone they love can wake up one morning and be murdered that evening by a coward that's supposed to protect them. This is a wake-up call to understand that we have to do something so that they don't live with the hurt and pain that we as families all over the world are feeling. This is a necessary step needed before we see a change. We protested in the streets, making our voices heard. Now it's time we come together as one and take action peacefully. My brother Dante Parker was a wise, caring, and loving man. A family man who enjoyed every bit of life and made the best out of every moment. He was a very proud and loving husband, father, son, brother, and so much more. My brother was an incredible big brother, and I am blessed that God allowed me to spend many wonderful years with him. August 12, 2014, my brother's life was taken by San Bernardino Sheriff. Since that day, our days have been extremely difficult, and the holidays are even harder. The hurt of our family and friends seemed like it would never end, but the love that we provide to one another keeps us going and helps us to hold our heads up high. For my brother Dante Parker, the fight will never end until justice is served. For the family and friends of those who have lost their lives to police brutality, know that you're not in this fight alone. You are embraced by the millions of people who feel your pain. Know that there is someone who understands just how you feel and is waiting for you with open arms, a shoulder to lean on, and an ear to listen, because we are all we have. Know that even if justice is not served here on earth, judgment will be done in heaven, in Jesus' name. Keep your heads held high, for the life that has been taken away from us has lived for God's purpose. Remember, vengeance is God's. For the families and friends of the church in Charleston, South Carolina, my prayers are with you all. The hateful crime is painful to us all, and shows the world just how far we have come and just how far we have to go. Another senseless crime that has affected the world and left a huge impact on us all. It's time we work for the change.
All right, Erica Parker, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now we're going to be hearing from Johanna Flores. Johanna Flores is the daughter of Ernesto Flores, who was murdered by San Bernardino County Sheriffs on April 15, 2015, in California. On April 15th, Johanna Flores called 911 to ask for help getting her agitated father out of her home in unincorporated Montclair, California. About 90 minutes later, San Bernardino County Sheriff's deputies fatally shot Ernesto Flores. Johanna had told the 911 dispatcher that her father had a BB gun. The sheriff's department said he pointed what appeared to be a rifle at a deputy, so they shot and killed him. I'm very pleased to be welcoming to the show today Johanna Flores, who has written a statement. She's participating in Rise Up October, 3 days of demonstrations and actions in New York City that's going to draw people from across the nation to participate in this. And Johanna wrote a very powerful statement about her feelings about October 24th in New York City and why people should be there. Johanna, welcome to the show.
Hi.
I asked you to come on to the show because I want people to hear your statement, which I think is a very powerful statement of what happened, what happens way too many times, and a call for resistance to this. So would you read your statement for people?
Yes, Rise Up October 24th in New York City is something that must be done. All these killings by police, we need to bring awareness. People don't know what's going on in the world. All the killings are getting covered up. On October 24th, we need to speak out. there's an urgency, and we need a campaign like this to bring the light. We need to fight for justice. We can't have everything get covered up. On October 24th, I would like to hold hands with people that are here to support us. I know I've gone through the same thing that I'm going through. Knowing that other people can understand me is something that I have no words for. You know, other people can be there as support, but people that have actually experienced this experience know that how important October 24th is. We need justice. We need to let people know that we haven't forgot about our family, our loved ones that have got killed by police. So October 24th is an amazing way to demonstrate that we haven't forgotten and nothing's going to get covered up. We need justice. We need to fight for justice. We are the voice. We need this to be heard. On April 15, 2015, I called for help in a moment of need. In return, the police killed my dad, Ernesto Flores. My dad was already on the floor when he was hit with rubber bullets. He received over 45 bullets, 12 were to the head. There was 9 police officers, 9 sheriff's officers that were involved, one of them being a sergeant that killed my father. My father had a breakdown. I needed professional help. He had no prior arrest, not even a citation, no prior incident. I needed help. I regret calling so much. He was an amazing father, the best grandpa. There was no need for this. 45 bullets. Who does this? Then they say, the caller said he had a gun. Really? I'm the caller. I'm his daughter. I called for help. I clearly told the dispatcher what was going on. I informed them that my dad had a rifle pellet gun. Another sheriff in the scene saw it and realized it wasn't a real one. Fontana and Chino Hills officers were involved. There was no real gun. We need justice. This needs to stop. Who are the police to decide what's going on? Who's going to live and who's going to die? And I could hear in the tape an officer saying, Ernesto, you want to F and die? Okay, you want to F and die. And a series of guns were released. My dad was in the floor the whole time. My father was executed in front of us. He was an amazing person. I needed help. That was it. We need real justice. Not 3-day suspension with pay. I want the other families who have lost a loved one to know that they're not alone. Together we can help each other. Bring this to light. We need light. We need some. We're together. We're going to fight for this. We need October 24th for justice. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks, Johanna. Take care now.
Bye.
All right, once again, those were the voices of two people whose family members were slaughtered by the police in Southern California. And they were calling on people all over the country to get involved in the initiative, Which Side Are You On? Rise Up October, a day dedicated to stopping police murder and police repression of black and brown people. And if you want to find out how to get involved in all this, you should go to the Stop Mass Incarceration website, or you can go to the website revcom.us. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be running an interview I did a number of years ago with Jim Lowen, the co-editor of the book, The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader, The Great Truth About the Lost Cause.
Get 'em in, get 'em in. That sun is hot and plenty bright. Let's get on to business and get home tonight. Bid 'em in. Auctioning slaves is a real high art. Bring that young gal, Roy, she's good for a start. Bid 'em in, get 'em in. Now here's a real goodbye on about 15. Her great-grandmammy was a die-homie queen. Just look at her face, she sure ain't homely. Like Sheba in the Bible, she's black but comely. Bid 'em in. Gonna start at 3. Can I hear 3? Step up, gents, take a good look, see.
Welcome back. That was Bid 'em In by Oscar Brown, the late, great Oscar Brown Jr. At a time when people are debating and struggling over what the Confederate flag and other symbols of slavery and white supremacy are all about, I thought that the following interview would shine a light of reality on Southern heritage and Southern pride and that great culture they all want to uphold. I spoke with James Lowen, co-editor of the Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader, The Great Truth About the Lost Cause. This book uses the words and documents of the Confederates and Neo-Confederates themselves to show that the Confederate leaders were honest and out front about why they started the Civil War. It was to protect slavery and a society based on white supremacy and slavery and the perpetual subjugation of black people. That's the heritage and tradition represented by the Confederate flag and all those statues and monuments to Confederate generals. So without any further ado, here's an interview I did a number of years back with James Lowen. I really am pleased to welcome to the show my next guest, James Lowen. Now, Jim's been a guest on the show a number of times before, and he's just come out with a new book, a book that he co-edited with Edward H. Sebesta. And the name of that book is The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader, The Great Truth About the Lost Cause. It's an incredibly, I mean, really a fascinating book. And again, once again, he's kind of opened my eyes up with, basically his ruthlessly honest and searching approach to history and really trying to make sure that people are talking about history accurately. Jim's the author of Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong, and Lies Across America, What Our Historic Sites Get Wrong. He's also the author of Teaching What Really Happened, How to Avoid the Tyranny of Textbooks, Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism, and a few other books, all of which number among my favorite books. Jim, welcome to the show.
Glad to be with you.
Okay, well, let's jump into this. As I said, this book was really kind of an eye-opener for me on many different levels. One, just the stuff that I learned, but also the kind of situation that you describe in the book. And I want you to tell people what the book is about and what compelled you to pull it together.
Sure. Well, I had another aha experience just last Friday. Now, of course, the book came out in August, and I wrote it before then. But this is the kind of thing that keeps happening. Last Friday, I was keynoting the American Association for State and Local History, which was meeting in Oklahoma City. Now, these are the folks who run history museums and historic houses and forts and stuff like that all across the U.S. So in the middle of my talk, I asked them, why did the South secede? Why did 11 states, beginning with South Carolina, leave the Federal Union? Well, there's always four answers you get, and they are: the South seceded over slavery, the South seceded because for states' rights, the South seceded because of the election of Lincoln, and the South seceded over tariffs and taxes, or issues about tariffs and taxes. So I said, okay, let's vote. And my one-liner is, unlike Chicago, you can only vote once. All right, everybody laughed, and then we proceeded to vote. And what happened was another one of these, we might call them an aha experience for me, only they've really become an oh-no experience. This time, more than 80% of the group voted states' rights. Now, states' rights always wins. When I do it with groups of teachers, it gets 60 to 75% of the vote. But here with historic site managers, it got at least 80%. Now, as you can already infer, that's not the right answer. Can I read from one of these documents?
Sure, definitely.
These folks just haven't ever read the documents, and the documents are never included, not even a phrase from them, is included in American history textbooks that you have in high school. So the very first state to leave the Union was, of course, South Carolina, and they left it on Christmas Eve, 150 years ago this Christmas. And here's why. They say why. Quote, "We assert that 14 of the states have deliberately refused for years past to fulfill their constitutional obligations, and we refer to their own statutes for the proof." Now, that sounds vague, constitutional obligations, but they go right on to tell us what they're talking about. They go on, "The Constitution of the United States, in its fourth article, provides as follows, quote, no person held to service or labor in one state, under the laws thereof, escaping into another, shall, in consequence of any law or regulation therein, be discharged from such service or labor, but shall be delivered up on claim of the party to whom such service or labor may be due." Well, that is, of course, the Fugitive Slave Clause. Uh-huh. And so it's beginning to look like slavery might be the right answer. And then they go on to talk about states' rights. And amazingly enough, they are against states' rights. And they tell us exactly which states and which rights upset them. And, for instance, they say, the states of Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, Massachusetts, and they name all the states going out to Iowa, all these states have enacted laws which either nullify the acts of Congress or render useless any attempt to execute them. And they go right back to the fugitive slave problem. And then they talk about, for example, the state of New York. Now, New York no longer allows what's called slavery transit. So this was a kind of idea, for instance, that a, well, let's suppose you're a rich family in Charleston, and you don't want to spend August in Charleston. You want to spend it maybe watching Broadway plays. But you don't want to do your own cooking, so you want to bring your cook along. Well, New York says, uh-uh, we're trying to be a free state. If you bring a slave into New York, she becomes free. Well, South Carolina is outraged at this. They're outraged as well with New England, because the New England states let blacks vote. Well, who votes in America was a state's right until the 15th Amendment gets passed two whole eras after this. But nevertheless, South Carolina takes it upon themselves to say, this is another reason we're seceding. These people are letting blacks vote. It's an outrage. So in other words, it's all about slavery and about the connecting thing with slavery, namely white supremacy. And it has nothing at all to do with states' rights, except that the southern states are against states' rights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very important point you make. And, you know, one of the things that you talk about, too, and you just sort of briefly mentioned this, but that this is, you know, there's all these other forces in society. You talk about historic site managers, but you also mentioned in your book even things like the National Archives website and yep. and teachers who really have, they're teaching things that are completely untrue about what was behind the Civil War.
Yep.
And, you know, and then textbooks. And that really kind of, that really sort of sits in your stomach and then just makes you
sick. Let me mention even, in a way, a worse one, because it's so blatant. Many folks in California have become naturalized citizens, right? They came in from Mexico or Vietnam or wherever they came in from as non-citizens. And then in order to become a citizen, you have to pass a history test, among other things. Mm-hmm. This is 100 multiple-choice questions. Each of them has one right answer, except for one question. The question, why did the southern states secede? And that one, they allow two right answers. Either the right answer, slavery, or if you say the wrong answer, states' rights, they count that right, too. So it's the only question on this federal test that has two right answers. And that right there shows the power of what we call the neo-Confederates even today.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking today with James Loewen. He's the co-editor of a new book called The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader, The Great Truth About the Lost Cause. I wanted to pursue this thing about the textbooks a little bit because,
sure. You
know, and it's related to what you just said. You know, in the book, you sort of cite a certain amount of relativism in the presentation of what was the cause of the Civil War, like you're saying right now with these two possible correct answers.
Yeah.
You know, and they come out, and there's a thing where people are saying even you can't know for sure what was really the cause of the Civil War.
You can, too.
Right, exactly, exactly. Well, I agree with you. And you present a few reasons why this happens, because it's very, you know, it's should give people pause to think that the textbooks are being written from a standpoint of you can't know for sure. And like you said, you can too. Why do you think the textbooks are written like this?
They don't want to offend anybody. And, you know, it's interesting. Like, when I speak all over the country. And when I speak in Columbia, South Carolina, for instance, I usually speak about what we get wrong about the Civil War and secession. You know, I have a talk, for instance, about what we get wrong about the American Indians and about the Pilgrims, but I save that for Massachusetts. Because I don't want to pull any punch, you know. And people come, and they listen, and even people like the Sons of Confederate Veterans, they come, they then ask questions. I don't think I've convinced them all, but they at least listen. But the textbook publishers are too timid to do that. And so they imagine that they might lose an adoption, and all of the southern states adopt statewide. Most infamously, of course, Texas adopts statewide. It's a more or less southern state. And the publishers certainly don't want to offend Texas. And saying just flatly that the South seceded for slavery might offend somebody. So let's not say that. And they'll say, well, historians debate why the Confederacy left the Union. Some say slavery, some states' rights, issues about tariffs, the election of Lincoln. They'll say all four of those in one paragraph. And they will never quote a document to support their position. And I think the key reason is because all of the documents support only one position, and that's slavery. Well, they do mention the election of Lincoln, that's for sure. But they're upset with the election of Lincoln because Lincoln represents a new party which is against slavery. So it all comes back to the S word in the end.
You know, one of the things that you mentioned in this, in the book, is you give about four reasons, and I really wanted to try and zero in on at least a couple of them, because one of them is you say, or maybe just this one, but you say that there's actually this point of not wanting to offend anybody, as you've just been talking about. And, you know, I just spoke with Peter Ward, who he's an environmental writer. He writes on climate change and melting of the ice caps, and he's also a paleontologist. And he was talking about the terrible time he has in trying to get what he's discovered or uncovered about the truth about global warming and the rest of this and climate change, and trying to get it out there, he gets a lot of flack. And he said that actually he's found that there's a tremendous amount of scientific reticence among scientists who are basically censoring themselves because they don't want to step out of the flock. They don't want to put themselves out there, not just because of the crude reason of I won't get, you know, research money, but also because they don't want to take the chance of being out there as the point man for something that is going to attract a lot of flack in society in general. Do you think that's also true in relation to these textbooks and how they're being written? And the fact that teachers even won't go to the sources that you have proven through this really impressive collection of Confederate and neo-Confederate documents that actually show the truth. Do you think that kind of reticence is also operational here?
Sure. I'd still just call it under the general heading of timidity. But yeah, they don't want to be the one textbook that gets off of Tennessee, for instance, adopts every competent book just about in American history. And actually, Tennessee would not knock a book out for this reason, I don't think. But publishers imagine they might, you know, so let's not say it.
Yeah. See, and that's the problem is when you're dealing with the question of seeking the truth, it's a big problem because if you're going to then present to others, and especially in, you know, involving textbooks and teachers, you would think that the purpose is to bring the truth to people in the classrooms. And
yeah, especially because the darn books are so huge. You know, the second edition of Lies My Teacher Told Me came out about 3 years ago, and it'll be the last edition, I can assure everyone. I'm not going to read any more of these textbooks. They're such a near-death experience. For that edition, I read six more of these books, and they've actually gotten longer. They now average 1,152 pages. And yet, with all those pages, they don't quote any documents, or almost no documents. For example, one of them actually has two whole paragraphs about Bryan's famous Cross of Gold speech, William Jennings Bryan's Cross of Gold speech. These two leaden paragraphs, written by whoever writes these textbooks, it isn't usually the names that are on them, only use three words from Bryan, and those are cross of gold. Now, William Jennings Bryan is a powerful writer, you know. He writes something like, thou shalt not press down upon labor's brow this crown of thorns. Thou shalt not crucify mankind on a cross of gold. Any 11th grader, any 6th grader could understand that better than they can understand the words of the textbook writers, but they don't quote them. And so they have this tradition of not quoting. They could just hide behind the documents. I think that'd be just fine. You know, let South Carolina tell you why it seceded. South Carolina is quite upfront about it.
Well, let's dig into this, because actually the point that you make in the book and what you show through all these documents is exactly what you're saying. They're upfront about this. There's the question of the Confederacy was really about, the Civil War was really about the preservation of slavery as an economic system, and then all the ideological trappings that go along with that, racism and white supremacy and so on. And, you know, the part of the problem or part of the thing that comes up here is, so you've mentioned in your most recent book what really happened. You get into the question of historiography, and I'm
yes.
curious as to how that applies to this situation.
Oh, it does indeed. That's a good question. And the reason our book is titled The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader is because we don't just have documents from the Confederacy period itself. After the Civil War ends, of course, we have Reconstruction. And now the same people, in this case, they're still Confederates. We might call them ex-Confederates because you can't be a Confederate anymore. But they still want to maintain their point of view. They can't maintain slavery because that was ended by the 13th Amendment. But they certainly can maintain white supremacy, which is, of course, the handmaiden of slavery. And so they do. I mean, at the end of Reconstruction, they reimpose white supremacy. And then, in 1890, beginning with Mississippi, all of the southern states proceed to keep blacks from voting, quote, legally, unquote. I mean, it's really illegal because it's all a violation of the 14th and 15th Amendments, but the U.S. doesn't do anything about it, and so they actually do it, quote, legally. Well, this sets in motion what we call the Nader. Some people pronounce it Nadir, N-A-D-I-R. We're not talking Ralph. the Nader of race relations. And this is the period 1890 to 1940 when the U.S. goes more racist in its ideology and its thinking than at any other point in our history. And it's during this time then that the neo-Confederates, and we have to call them neo-Confederates now because most of the Confederates are dead. We're talking 1890 to 1940. It's a new generation. But they still maintain elements of the Confederate line. They certainly maintain the emphasis on white supremacy. And now they actually rename the Civil War, and they no longer call it the Civil War. Now is when it gets called the War Between the States. And now, 1890 to 1940, is when they start making the claim that secession was for states' rights. And so if you just page through our book, you can see the reasons for secession changing as you go through the years and as you go through the pages.
I was going to ask you about that in terms of the through line between the Confederates and the neo-Confederates. It's, you know, this point about maintaining this notion of white supremacy and the inferiority of black people to white people. It's not that they're still fighting the Civil War in one sense, but in another sense, they are still fighting. And it's not so much to reinstitute slavery, but it does this question of actually maintaining the domination of black people, the subordinate position of black people and the domination of them by white people in relation to the whole political and economic setup certainly seems to be serviced by this continuation of that understanding of the Civil War.
And you know, one thing a lot of people don't realize, a lot of younger people don't have any idea that the Republicans weren't always the party of white supremacy as they now are. In the 19th century, the Democrats were the party of white supremacy. And they said so, and they called themselves the white man's party well into the 1920s. But in 1964, the two parties completed a flip-flop on this matter. And as one of the actual documents in our book, we show two maps of votes for president for Abraham Lincoln in 1860 and then for John Kerry in 2004. And by gosh, the same states that Abraham Lincoln carried, John Kerry carried, with only three exceptions. Lincoln carried Iowa, Ohio, and Indiana, and Kerry didn't manage to carry them. But the map looks almost identical. So the people, it's a flip-flop then, of the people who supported Kerry were, in their antecedent generations, the people who supported Lincoln.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with James Loewen. He's the co-editor of a new book called The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader, The Great Truth About the Lost Cause. Now, let's talk about the relevance of all this for today. You know, I have to tell you, when my son was growing up, I was living in Washington, D.C., and one of the things that happened, here we were living in a majority black city, and yes, the neighborhood we were in, it was majority black and immigrant, and my son was really deep into watching The Dukes of Hazzard.
Yes.
And he wasn't the only one in the neighborhood. And he wasn't the only nationality, you know, in the neighborhood,
yeah,
in terms of, you know, watching it. It was actually all the kids, they all went out and they got big wheels, they used to call them. The king.
Yeah, and I think what we have to do is we have to tell your readers that The Dukes of Hazzard drove around in this red car that had a Confederate flag painted on its roof.
That's exactly where I was going.
I knew that's where you're going.
Right, exactly. And my son got a big wheels that came complete with Confederate flags to stick all over the place, patches, all this stuff. He was so irate when I told him he was not going to put that on there. But it just struck me in thinking about this, because at that time there was that thing going on. And then I remember at the same time there was the struggle to have Martin Luther King's birthday declared a holiday. And at one point, Virginia opted,
yes,
to, they said, okay, we'll do it, but we're going to do it on the same day as Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson Day.
Yep.
You know, and to me, you know, it really fits in a lot with what you're actually pointing out in this book.
Yep. At this point, the neo-Confederates have, in terms of any explicitness, they've kind of given up on white supremacy. And so the most recent document we include in the book, actually, is Republican Governor Sonny Perdue of Georgia, his proclamation of Confederate History Month 2 years ago. And, of course, like all proclamations, it's got all these whereases. But it's very interesting. The number one whereas in there is this one. Whereas, among those who served the Confederacy were many African Americans, both free and slave, who saw action in the Confederate armed forces in many combat roles. Well, that's not true. That's flatly not true. It's less true than the idea that there's a whole bunch of Jewish officers in Hitler's army, which actually was true. There were no blacks in combat roles in the Confederate Army who were known to be black until 3 weeks before the end of the war. And the reason there weren't is because the Confederate policy wouldn't allow it. And so we include these documents that we don't allow no blacks. And then we furthermore include the document 3 weeks before Richmond gets liberated where they changed their minds. And so the question comes up, why would Sonny Perdue write something that's so completely false? And I think the answer is, the reason it goes like this. Look, you people, we're going to celebrate Confederate Heritage Month, and we all should celebrate it because it couldn't have been about slavery. It couldn't have been about white supremacy because, look, all these black folks fought on our side. See, it's a non sequitur, but besides that, it didn't happen.
But let me ask you this, the point about white supremacy. I know what you're saying in terms of they sort of similarly to how the neo-Confederates had to back off of actually doing the thing around, well, we were about slavery and we did think slavery was important and all this, and they couldn't really make that the central argument point. But they could then get into white supremacy. And, you know, you saw it in a lot of different ways where they were talking about they were so upset. All the way up into the 1970s, they were still arguing about the natural stupidity of black people.
Oh, yeah.
And it's developed over the course of time. But it seems to me it's a little hard, I think, to say that they have given up on the promotion of white supremacy because you look at this
stuff. Oh, I still think that's their goal. It's certainly the goal of the Council of Concerned Citizens, for instance,
exactly,
which is one of the primary neo-Confederate organizations around right now. And people who are in the sense of Confederate veterans fall into two groups, I think. The white supremacists and people who lost family members generations ago, admittedly, but still, in the Confederate Army, and they want to mainly honor them. And I appreciate that that's a different frame of mind. But there's something dangerous about the whole states' rights claim. And what's dangerous about it is that it has converted the Confederacy into kind of a David against Goliath romantic figure with whom we wish to identify. And this has several payoffs to today. Let me just mention a couple of them. I was just in Oklahoma City at this meeting. And, of course, Oklahoma City, about 10 years ago, was the site of this horrific bombing of the federal building, the Murrah office building. The number one guy who did it, Timothy McVeigh, he was photographed, arrested, I think, and certainly photographed for his mugshot, wearing a T-shirt. And it was a neo-Confederate T-shirt. And the T-shirt says, it has a picture of Abraham Lincoln in the front, and it says, "Sic semper tyrannis, thus always with tyrants," which is, of course, what John Wilkes Booth yelled on the stage of Ford's Theater right after he killed him. And so McVeigh is identifying with Booth. McVeigh is saying, we should kill the president. We should kill our leaders. Well, you're hearing that from some of the far-out members of the Tea Party folks. This woman in Nevada says, you know, bring your guns to Washington, and so on. And there is talk about secession by candidates for governor in Georgia, by the governor of Texas, by Mr. Sarah Palin, if you will, when he was a member of the Alaska First Party. That's a secessionist party in Alaska. And it's not necessarily totally harmless. I mean, the folks in Oklahoma City don't think this ideology is harmless one bit.
One of the things your book pointed out to me that I had no idea and hadn't really followed, and I'm sure, again, if I had really looked into it, as you say, the documents are there. What is the name of the journal, The Southern Partisan? And then
yes,
there's the book by the Kennedy. I guess they're brothers.
Yes, these are two neo-Confederate Kennedys.
Right.
Go ahead. The South was right.
The South was right. Right. I was going to say that's the basic premise of their book. And also this guy, Frank Connor. These are things that still play a very, not just, you know, symbolic role in American politics today, but actually some of these people have direct links to whether it's the Christian fundamentalist movement or McCain's campaign or any of these things.
They do. Trent Lott was tied in with them. Of course, he's out of politics now, but he wasn't. He was minority leader of the Senate, sometimes majority leader, depending on which side James Jeffers was on.
All right, Jim, one last question here. Speaking from your heart, from the very bottom of your heart, the importance of this book today and why people should pick this thing up.
Here's what I want folks to do. And I don't usually flog my books. They seem to do okay without it. But I want folks, including black folks, to buy this book with what we usually call the Confederate flag on the cover. It's the battle flag, anyway. Mm-hmm. And I want them to buy it and read it and keep it nice. Don't mark in it. Make your notes on the side on a piece of paper. And then take it to your nearby public high school and give it to your kid's history teacher or your own history teacher if you're young enough to have already just graduated from high school. Hit him upside the head with it and say, look, it's been 150 years. It's time to stop lying. It's time to get this right. It does make a difference. And then, by gosh, maybe we can change these historic sites, for instance, by simply having visitors go who know better and who hit them upside the head with this book and say, no. You cannot make it about states' rights anymore. That is a white supremacist myth. It removes the number one issue, which was race and slavery, from its position at the center of American history, and it just won't do anymore.
Exactly. All right. That's from Jim Lowen talking about the Confederate and neo-Confederate reader, The Great Truth About the Lost Cause. All right. We're going to be real quick. We got no time. I want to thank everybody who was involved in producing the show today and all of you who are listening to it. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. Talk to you again next week.